Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett. Up next, my unedited conversation with psychiatrist and trauma researcher Bessel van der Kolk. And there is a shorter produced version of this wherever you found this podcast.
Hello, hello. Yeah, okay.
There we go. Got it now.
You hear me now? Hello?
Yes, hello.
Oh, hi. It's Krista Tippett.
Could be a little louder if you can make it.
I'm working on the headphone.
Okay. Yep.
Go ahead.
Hello, it's Krista Tippett.
Hi, Krista.
Hi. Would you say your name for me? I want to say it perfectly.
My name is Bessel van der Kolk.
Van der Kolk, okay. Do you have any... Thank you. First of all, thank you for coming. I have so enjoyed kind of steeping in your work, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation, and I'm glad we could reschedule it for today. Do you have any questions for me before we start?
No, I'll just plunge into the unknown.
All right, that's good. Right. Okay, let's talk about something mundane first so we can get levels. Tell me what you had for breakfast.
I had some yogurt and strawberries for breakfast.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. And some lox. And,
oh, you did?
And some toast. Yeah, oh, yeah, right. Yeah, the good breakfast, yeah.
Okay. How are we, Chris? Can we start? All right, let's do this.
Okay, I'm going to step out of the booth.
Okay. Oh, my producer wanted me to ask you if you have a Twitter feed.
I don't actually, no.
All right, okay. So let's just begin. You grew up in the Netherlands, is that correct?
Well, part in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. I was 18 when I came here.
Okay.
It's been a while.
Okay. I always start my conversations with this question, whoever I'm speaking with. I'm just wondering, was there a religious or spiritual background to your childhood?
Yeah, multiplicity. My parents were fundamentalist Christians in some good and some not so good ways. And as an adolescent, I spent a fair amount of time in a monastery in France called Thésée.
Oh, you did?
Uh-huh.
Oh, interesting. So you went to Thésée just...
Because I loved the music.
Yeah.
I loved Gélinot.
Yes. Wow. That's fascinating.
But it was still very small at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. And then, you know, this field you're in of trauma, traumatic stress, nowadays in 2013... This language is everywhere, right? This language of trauma and traumatic stress has made its way into culture, movie, TV scripts, the news, public policy discussions. But I wonder if you trace any, what was this something that you were aware of in your earlier life, perhaps by different names? If you look back to any roots of, why this so captured your imagination.
Well, these are always retrospective accounts, I'm one of five kids, and I'm the only one of five who is really fascinated by this topic. So it is... What I was just telling somebody yesterday is that my father was in a German concentration camp for religious reasons. And he would come back, and he was quite an authoritarian man. And from very early on, I would point out to him the contradictions between what he professed to believe in and how he actually acted. And the contradictions between people saying nice things and doing other things has always been very much central to my observations, including how trauma pervades our society and how there's this need to deny large chunks of reality. For example, just before invading another country, we know the data on what will happen to soldiers who go off to war after they come home. And those are very well spelled out in the past 100 years. But when we go off to war, nobody says if we go to war, of the survivors, more will kill themselves after coming home than will have died on the battlefield. And even though they start off being relatively nice people, they're likely to commit atrocities. And about half of them will get drug addiction, alcohol problems. Mm. So there's a lot of facts that are out there which we choose to ignore.
We don't reckon with. So I've read a few different accounts of how you stumbled into this field. How do you trace the beginnings of your research into traumatic stress?
Well, it starts in a very pedestrian way. I'm a psychiatrist from a generation that it was generally recommended that people have their own heads examined, which I think is sort of a good idea.
Yes.
If you try to help other people. And so psychoanalysis was the way to do that back then. And the only program that paid for that was the VA. Mm. So I went to work for the VA for the same reason that soldiers go to the VA, namely to get their benefits package.
Okay. And this was in the 1970s, is that right?
In the 1970s, yeah. And like many of my colleagues, I was just there to as a step in my career. Mm. And then the very first person I saw was a Vietnam veteran who had terrible nightmares. I happened to have studied nightmares up to that point. I'd done some sleep studies on that. And I knew a little bit how to treat it, so I gave him some medicines to make the nightmares go away. And 2 weeks later, he came back and I said, so how did the medicines work? And he said, I did not take your medicines because I realized I need to have my nightmares because I need to be a living memorial to my friends who died in Vietnam.
Mm.
And that statement was the opening of my fascination about how people become living testimonials for things that no longer exist, but they need to hold it in their hearts and minds and bodies and brains. And the loyalty to the dead, the loyalty to what was, just blew me away. And the veterans really touched me very deeply, both for what they had done, how ashamed they were about what they had done, how they went in idealistically, how they came back broken, how they relied on their comrades. And they reminded me, I think, of the uncles and my father who I grew up with in the Netherlands after the Second World War. So it resonated with me.
And at that time, I believe there was no formal connection made between military service and problems after discharge, right? This diagnosis hadn't happened?
Well, it comes and goes. You know, I became quite interested in the history of how Western culture has looked at trauma.
Yeah.
And people were very aware of it in the 1880s and after the Civil War and during the First World War and during the Second World War. And then in between, it gets forgotten. So at the time that I started to see these guys, it was a forgotten period.
Mm.
And so it's amazing how the culture gets deeply preoccupied with it. And then there's always a reaction against it. There's always a backlash against victims, against veterans, which if you want me to, I can be happy to talk about. And then so from idealizing and putting the veterans on the pedestal, they always get ignored and abandoned. That's the history of the field. And so the time that I got into the field happened to be a time that of ignorance again.
But
these things come and go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And my understanding from your writing is that this diagnosis of PTSD, the term we use now, came about because of post-Vietnam War advocacy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so later on, I became aware of all sorts of colleagues who had been working with abused kids and rape victims, and they had been trying to get a diagnosis in. And that group was too small to have any political clout. And it was really the Vietnam veterans that brought this in, and the power of the large numbers of psychiatrists and patients at the VA that was strong enough to make it an issue and a diagnosis.
Right. And so then once you had that diagnosis, then you started to be able to apply it to these other kinds of populations of trauma victims.
Yeah, not, there were always people who were doing that. So it's not like there's always people who see the abuse and study it. But there's always the question, does the culture do, research agencies do, diagnostic manuals do, books recognize that. And indeed, as a consequence, issues of child abuse and domestic violence also became more and more recognized. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that that language you used a moment ago about that first veteran you spoke with, that he was a living testimonial to his memories and to something that had happened, which no longer was happening, but utterly defined him, right? This is a good way into how you define trauma. And so I'd like to spend a moment on that. I mean, start with me. You know, how do you describe what this is, trauma, as you deal with it, as you study it, as you treat it?
Yeah. Well, what I think happens is that, you know, people have terrible experiences, and we all do, and we are a very resilient species. So if we are around people who love us, trust us, take care of us, nurture us when we are down, most people do pretty well with even very horrendous events. But particularly traumas that occur at the hands of people who are supposed to take care of you, if you're not allowed to feel what you feel, know what you know, your mind cannot integrate what goes on, and you can get stuck on the situation. So the social context in which it occurs is fantastically important. We saw an example of that after 9/11 in New York, is that people were upset and very affected by what happened, but very few people got traumatized by it. Mm-hmm. Very few people got stuck. And that's really because there was such an overwhelming outpouring of sympathy, support, et cetera, et cetera. You see the same thing now after the Boston Marathon bombing, is that by and large, those victims will probably do okay. Also because we have really discovered ways of helping people very effectively these days with one-time trauma. What emerged in my work, and not everybody, so sort of my particular bailiwick, is the amount of trauma that occurs in the context of intimate relationships, caregiving relationships, in the context of relationships where you should expect to be heard, listened to, and understood.
Right. I think this is such an interesting point you make, that as human beings, from the moment of birth, we are dependent on others to relieve distress. And, right? And I mean, you know, of course, it's a simple idea, but it's so striking to name it, to articulate it. And that then when the people who are supposed to make you safe become the source of trauma, it's very distorting. It's very distorting.
Right. And what's striking to me in my profession is that there's this insistence on seeing people as individual organisms who are independent of the social environment. And even in the new diagnostic manual, DSM-5, there's virtually nothing that talks about or addresses the issue that of our interdependence and how the social context in which we live has a very profound effect on how we feel and how we see ourselves and how we get along, and et cetera, et cetera.
And how we are damaged or able to be resilient in the face of trauma. Yeah. And so tell me how this applies then in the experience of veterans. Is it because they are so utterly outside a context in which there is any concern for their distress? I mean,
well, it is somewhat different for veterans, but you know, the veterans are such a continuous high level involvement in very high stressful situations, and people bond very strongly to the people in the field.
Yes, yes.
There's no friendship like the friendship that's formed on the battle. And a colleague of mine in Australia, Alexander McFarland, right now, is studying every single Australian soldier who is sent to war, and studies sort of basically every known biological variable known to mankind. And what he finds is that the brains of these guys move to become very hyper alert to danger, to the present time, and become less and less capable of being quiet under ordinary circumstances. And with every new deployment, you see a more abnormal activation of brain waves in the direction of being focused on threat and not being focused on day-to-day experiences.
Right.
So that's just, that, and it, so these things all live side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the issue of soldiers gets complicated if, as often happens, soldiers under these extreme situations do things or see things or stand helplessly by as things happen that are profoundly disturbing and that oftentimes involves extreme cruelty.
Right.
And we don't do well with killing.
We human beings.
We as human beings. Mm-hmm. People tend to have a hard time seeing other people being blown away and killed at their own hands. And seeing that is very hard for human beings.
So something that's very interesting to me in how you talk about trauma, the experience of trauma, what it is how the nature of memory is distorted, that memories are never precise recollections, but that in general, as we move through the world, memories become integrated and transformed into stories that help us make sense. But that when, in the case of traumatic memories, they're not integrated and they're not even really remembered as much as they're relived.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's actually a very old observation. You know, it was made extensively in the 1890s already by various people, including Freud. And that's really what you see when you see traumatized people. You know, these days now the trauma is a popular subject. People say, tell me about your trauma.
Right.
But the nature about trauma is that you actually have no recollection for it as a story, in a way. Many victims over time get to tell a story to explain why they are so messed up. But the nature of a traumatic experience is that the brain doesn't allow a story to be created. And here you have an interesting paradox that it's normal to distort your memories. Like, you know, as I told you, I'm one out of five kids. When we have a family reunion, we all tell stories about our own childhood.
Yeah.
And everybody always listens to everybody else's story and says, did you grow up in the same family as I did?
Right, like, there are five versions of every story.
There's all these very, very different versions and they barely ever overlap. So people create their own realities in a way.
Mm-hmm.
What is so extraordinary about trauma is that these images or sounds or physical sensations don't change over time. So people who have been molested as kids continue to see the wallpaper of the room in which they were molested, or these when they examined all these priest abuse victims, they keep seeing the silhouette of the priest standing in the door of the bathroom and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's these images, these sounds, that don't get changed. So it's normal to change. My old teacher, George Valian, did a very, he was in charge of a study that you may have heard about. It's called the Grant Study. And from 1932 to 1942, 1939 to 1942, they followed the classes at Harvard at that time.
Right.
And they followed them up every 5 years, and it's going on to this day. So these guys are very old now, and most of them have died. Most of them went off to war in 1942, and almost all of them came back in 1945, and they were interviewed. So you have these old interviews from 1945 in which they tell their stories. And then they have interviews in 1989, 1990, 1991. And it turns out that the people who did not develop PTSD, which is the vast majority, tell very different stories, let's say in 1990, than back in 1945.
Huh.
And so now is a glorious experience, and it was a growth experience, and how cool it was, how close they were to people, and how patriotic they felt. And it's all sort of cleaned up.
Right. But it's become a coherent narrative.
But it's very coherent, and it's a nice story, and it's good to listen to it, and the relatives have all heard it a million times, but everybody's happy,
mm-hmm.
Because we make happy stories in our mind. The people who got traumatized continue to have the same story in 1990 as they told back in 1945.
Right.
So they cannot transform it.
So when
we treat people,
mm-hmm.
You see the narrative change. And people start introducing new elements. I compare it very much to what happens when people dream. Maybe dreaming is very central here, actually, in that the natural way in which we deal with difficult stuff is we go to sleep and we dream, and next day we feel better. It's very striking, mm-hmm. huh, how get upset and then say, I'm going to move to Florida, bummer day in Boston in the winter. And the next morning you wake up and you shovel out your car and everything's fine. And so you sleep is a very important way in which we restore ourselves. And that process of that restoration that occurs during REM sleep, dream sleep, is probably in part an important factor in why traumatic memories do not get integrated.
And in victims of trauma, there are nightmares, right? And so, I mean, even that is disrupted.
And the nightmares, again, see what happens with nightmares is that many of them don't occur during dreams. They occur in the middle of the deepest part of sleep where people have no mental content. They just feel intense fear or they see an image, but it's not like a dream.
Right.
The dreams are a different phenomenon, which also can be terrifying dreams, but they're not as traumatic as these night terrors. But people wake themselves up out of these dreams in which the trauma comes back. And in part, probably because they wake themselves up, the trauma doesn't get integrated.
And also that gets at the fact that this is not, it's not just cognitive, right? It's not just a story that you could tell. I mean, it may eventually become a story, but that it's body memory. It's a, it's a neural net of memory.
Yeah.
It's not just about words that you can formulate. Yeah.
It's amazing to me what a hard time many people I know have with that. This is not about something you think or something you figure out. This is about your body, your organism, having been reset to interpret the world as a terrifying place and yourself as being unsafe. And it has nothing to do with cognition, with, you know, you can say to people, you shouldn't feel that way, or you're not a bad person, or it wasn't your fault. And people say, I know that, but I feel that it is.
Right, right.
You can say to it was very striking in our yoga study, because we see yoga as one important thing that helps people who've been traumatized because they get back into their bodies.
Yeah.
How hard it was for people to, even during the most blissful part of the yoga practice called Shavasana, what a hard time traumatized people had at that moment to just feel relaxed and safe and feel totally enveloped with goodness. And the sense of goodness and safety disappears out of your body, basically.
I want to talk about yoga in a minute. That's really so this gets at why, as you said, I mean, people were talking about this in the late 19th century. Freud talked about it, and I mean, I guess his phrase was hysteria. But something that you seem to have noticed early on is that traditional therapy was ignoring this sensate dimension of these experiences, and trying to reduce it to talk therapy, which absolutely didn't fit with the experience.
Right, right. There's a few people here and there in the last 150 years who do it. The great Frenchman Pierre Janet did. Wilhelm Reich, of course, who then went crazy afterwards. So here and there, people notice the somatic dimension of it. But by and large, I think psychology training really breeds attention to the body out of people.
Right.
Even medical training. It's amazing. Psychiatrists just don't pay much attention to sensate experience at all.
And this, so you're part of the field of what is called neurobiology, and is that in fact a way to describe what neurobiology is doing, putting the body back into the equation?
No, I wouldn't say so. You know, there is Centers for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT and Harvard, extremely well run, well funded, fascinating places. But the body experience is not a central part of what the lectures I hear there. I preoccupied with. I have a colleague, a former friend of mine, who is a professor at the University of Western Ontario, who is a very hardcore neuroscientist who studies that experience. But very few people do. Antonio Damasio.
Yes.
In his books, The Feeling of What Happens, in books like that, really talks about our core experience of ourselves is a somatic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that the function of the brain is to take care of the body. But it's a minority voice. It's a small voice.
But it seems to me that what we're learning from brain imaging is bearing out these kinds of observations? I mean, what are we learning? Is any of this surprising?
What we see is that the parts of the brain that help people to think clearly and to observe things clearly really get interfered with by trauma. And the imprint of trauma is in areas of the brain that really have no access to cognition. So it's in an area called the periaqueductal gray, which sort of has something to do with the sort of total safety of the body. The amygdala, of course, which is sort of the smoke detector, alarm bell system of the brain. That's where the trauma lands, and trauma makes that part of the brain hypersensitive or renders it totally insensitive. There's a part of the brain called the insula, which sort of connects your aware brain with your body and tells you whether something feels pleasurable or disgusting or good or tasteful, and that you anticipate before you go out in the morning. Let's say the insula lights up to tell you it's nice weather outside and let's put on some nice dress, or it feels rainy outside, so let's put an umbrella up. And this part of your body sort of helps you to imagine what your body feels like out there. That part of your body gets very messed up by trauma. And then the self-observational part of the brain that you need to really know what's going on inside of you also gets quite destroyed, quite impaired.
And the Broca's area?
Well, in our study and some others, for me that was really the great finding early on, is that when people are into their trauma, Broca's area shuts down. And that is something that almost everybody has experienced. When you get really upset with your partner or your kid, suddenly you take leave of your senses and you say horrible things to that person. And afterwards you say, oh, I didn't mean to say that. Well, the reason why you said it is because Broca's area, which is sort of the part of your brain that helps you to say reasonable things and to understand things and articulate them, shuts down. So when people really become very upset, that whole capacity to put things into words in an articulate way disappears.
For
me, that's a very important finding because it helped me to realize that if people need to overcome the trauma, we need to also find methods that bypass what they call the tyranny of language.
Right. Don't ask people to be verbal, to verbalize it.
Or to be reasonable. The trauma is not about being reasonable or to be verbal or to be articulate.
And I mean, something else in your writing is that it seems like trauma, there are all these impulses that we have that we're working with all the time that get so out of whack with trauma. And so, I mean, I've understood that it's not just that we have memories and that we and we process them in different ways, but also that we are constantly rationalizing, that we have this impulse to rationalize. But then when people are traumatized, they are actually they also have this impulse to rationalize and then become unable to grasp the irrelevance of that memory and that feeling to the present moment.
Well, this is, of course,
hello. Can you guys hear anything? Oh, shoot. Did they hear it happen too? Okay. I know. It's true. We're not gonna never gonna do anything at WBUR again.
Hello.
Oh, hello.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, very faintly.
Something seems to have shifted. Can you hear me better now?
Yes. We just lost your voice.
Something may have changed here, but I may have figured something. Can you hear me now?
Hello?
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, good. Yeah, you're
back.
Can
you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. You just... Is he? Okay. We need to work on the sound. You just, your voice just disappeared at the beginning of that last answer.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But you can hear me okay now?
I can hear you. My producer is saying that your voice sounds a little muffled.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Do you think
I can move some dials along.
Is the engineer there?
Hello?
Oh, hello?
There's nobody here who can help me.
Okay, yeah, we will call the engineer.
Uh-huh.
Sorry. I'm so sorry, we're right in the middle of
this. I can hear
you
fine.
Okay. Are we okay?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, no, I guess no. We can't. My engineer is working with the people at your end, so let's... Okay.
Yes. I changed my... No, what happened is that I moved my chair a little bit, and with it I seem to have pulled on something here.
Oh.
Yeah, as soon as the engineer gets here. You sound perfectly reasonable to me, so...
It sounds fine to me, too, but I guess something changed in the quality, sound quality.
Uh-huh.
I'm really enjoying this.
You ask very good questions. I like talking about this. Okay, good.
Okay, all right. I don't want us to keep talking because I don't want us to say anything that we won't be able to use, so...
Okay.
Do you still have lots of family in the Netherlands?
I'm actually going tomorrow, but somehow I've lucked out to be taught to teach in the Netherlands about once a year for the last 30 years or so.
Oh, that's great.
But I'm a foreigner there, you know, like I speak the language, but I've lived here for so long now that I consider myself a Boston Brahmin.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, sort of, with an accent.
Yeah.
But an intriguing country, but it's far away.
It is an intriguing country. I spent quite a lot of time in Germany in the 1980s, and mostly in Berlin, in that very different world of the Cold War and the division.
Yeah.
And I got
Germany
to
still Berlin still freaks me out. It's interesting. My daughter is a dancer and choreographer, and she loves dancing in Berlin. And I go to Berlin, and all I hear is the SS marching through the streets and the communists and stuff. And so there's the issue of perception again. I see Berlin through the lens of history and I cannot get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And people who were born in the last 30 years or so, 40 years, don't have those associations and they feel very, very happy there.
So it should just be just a second.
Okay.
They'll
be ready to go.
I think somebody's about to come.
Okay. I'm kind of surprised that they went so far away.
I am too.
Yeah.
I see the guy walking around, and he seems to be in absolutely no hurry to.
Yeah. We wouldn't do that to you if you were here.
Where are you located?
We're in Minnesota.
Oh, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah, the show is on the air in Boston. I mean, it's on all over, but we produce in Minnesota.
I know.
Yeah. He's
taking his time.
Hmm? Okay.
I moved this wire and something happened here.
That goes down.
Okay.
Pull back into the microphone. See if I can hear you.
All right.
Hello.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is better?
That's good. Chris, are you good? Yeah.
We're good? Okay.
Okay.
They're hearing you?
Yeah, they're hearing me fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Are we?
Okay. We can go back.
Do you remember we were at...
We were
so animated about rationality. Mm. Was it about?
Oh, right. That was great. Yeah. So we have these two different parts of our brain, and they're really quite separate. Huh? So we have our animal brain that makes us go to sleep and makes us hungry and makes us turn on to other human beings in a sexual way, stuff like that. And then we have our rational brain that makes us get along with other people in a civilized way. These two are not all that connected to each other.
Mm.
And so the more upset you are, the more shut down your rational part of your brain. And what I was about to say is that, you know, when you look at the political discourse, is that everybody can rationalize what they believe in and talk endlessly about why what they believe is the right thing to do, mm-hmm. while your emotional responses are totally at variance with those seemingly rational behaviors. And it's also striking how little our arguments, let's say about gun control, really have an effect on people who have different opinions.
Right.
We can talk till the blue in the face, but if our primitive part of our brain perceives something in a particular way, it's almost impossible to talk ourselves out of it, which of course makes sort of verbal psychotherapy also extremely difficult because that part of the brain is so very hard to access.
Yeah, we're pretty fascinating creatures, aren't we?
Fascinating, disturbing, yes. Glorious, all those things.
things all at once. Right. So I do want to talk about yoga now, which is something very important to me as well, something I've discovered in the last 5 or 6 years. And how did you get interested? How did you discover yoga and then make that part of this kind of work?
We actually got into yoga in a very strange way. We learned that there is a way of measuring the integrity of your reptilian brain, i.e. How the very most primitive part of your brain deals with arousal. And the way you measure that is with something called heart rate variability. And that tells you something about how your breath and your heart are in sync with each other. And it turns out that the calmer people are and the more mindful people are, the higher their heart rate variability is. And then we were doing that on some traumatized people, and we noticed that they had lousy heart rate variability. Mm. And then I thought, so how can we change people's heart rate variability?
And is this something you'd naturally be aware of or not? You wouldn't
know.
No,
but you can measure it, and it's fairly easy to measure it.
Okay.
Like there are like apps for your iPhone on which you can measure them.
Yeah.
But, of course, we do it in a more sophisticated way. Mm-hmm. And so we found this very abnormal heart rate variability in traumatized people. And then we heard that there were 17,000 yoga sites that claimed that yoga changed heart rate variability. And a few days later, some yoga teachers walked by our clinic and said, hey, do you think you can use this for some project? And I said, we sure can. We'd love to see if yoga changes heart rate variability. And this whole yoga thing also fit very well with the increasing recognition that traumatized people cut off their relationship to their bodies.
Right.
And I have to give a little bit of background here. That way back already in 1872, Charles Darwin wrote a book about emotions, in which he talks about how emotions are expressed in things like heartbreak and gut-wrenching experience. So you feel things in your body.
Yeah.
And that's sort of been a subtext in psychology for a long time and keeps getting ignored, but Darwin nailed it. And Darwin started to really show what the neuronal connections are with these intense physical experiences. And then it became obvious that if people are in a constant state of heartbreak and gut-wrench, they do everything to shut down those feelings in their body. Hmm. One way of doing it is taking drugs and alcohol. And the other thing is that you can just shut down your emotional awareness of your body. And so a very large number of traumatized people who we see, I'd say the majority of the people we treat at the trauma center and in my practice, have very cut-off relationship to their bodies. They may not feel what's happening in their bodies. They may not register what's going on with them. And so what became very clear is that we needed to help people to feel, feel safe feeling the sensations in their bodies, to start having a relationship with the life of their organism, as I like to call it.
Mm.
And so a combination of events really led us into exploring yoga for that. And yoga turned out to be a very wonderful method for traumatized people to activate exactly the areas of consciousness, the areas of the brain, the areas of your mind that you need in order to regain ownership over yourself.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I don't think that yoga would be the only way to do it, or I think if you only do yoga that you can totally take care of it. But yoga, to my mind, is an important component of an overall healing program. Mm-hmm. And again, not only yoga, you could do maybe martial arts or qigong, but something that engages your body in a very mindful and purposeful way, with a lot of attention to breathing in particular, resets some critical brain areas that get very disturbed by trauma.
And you, do you also have a yoga practice?
I also have a yoga practice. Uh-huh. I do not enough, of course. None of us ever does enough, but I try to start every day with a yoga practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did I read somewhere that you also found that your heart rate variability was not in sync and it was not robust enough?
I like to keep quiet about it. That's true. That's true.
And do you know if yoga has helped your...
I have a nice even heart rate variability now. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I wonder if you have ever heard of somebody named Matthew Sanford, who I've had on my program. He's actually...
No.
He's a very renowned yoga teacher. He's been paraplegic since he was 13.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And his story is that he, about 20 years after that trauma, yoga helped him... what he understood, which is very much in sync with how you're saying it, you know, what he understood is that his body, he had no memory of the accident in which he was disabled and his father was killed and his sister, but his body remembered it. Right? I mean, he talks about body memory. Yeah. It's the same thing you say, this imprint that trauma has, not just on your mind. And the other thing that he's doing recently is actually working with veterans and also working with, and this hasn't been on the show, these are just conversations I'm having with him, that he's working with young women suffering from anorexia. Hmm. And understanding also that although that seems to be so much an obsession with the body, they are really in a traumatic relationship with their own bodies. And some of the things he's doing, which he actually did for me, I did a class with him, like just putting these very comforting weights, you know, on certain muscles. And you feel sunk into your body in a way. And I don't know, I've been thinking about this as I've been reading about your research.
Huh. I think I've heard about him. The name escaped me. But it sounds very sympathetic and very right. Huh?
Yes.
These sensory experiences of feeling weights and feeling your substance.
Feeling your substance, which is bigger than just feeling a weight on your muscles, isn't it?
I mean, it's... No, really feeling your body move and the life inside of yourself is critical. And, you know, personally, for example, when people ask me, so what sort of treatment have you explored? I always explore every treatment that I explore for other people. What's been most helpful for me has been Rolfing.
It's been what?
Rolfing. Rolfing is called after Ida Rolf. It's a very deep tissue work where people tear your muscles from your fascia. And with the idea that at a certain moment your body comes to be contracted in a way that you habitually hold yourself. And so your body sort of takes on a certain posture. And the idea of Rolfing is that you really open up all these connections and make the body flexible again in a very deep way. I had asthma as a kid. I was very sickly as a kid. Mm. I was part of the group in the Netherlands. I mean, the final year of the war in the Netherlands, during which I was born, about 100,000 kids died. Mm. From starvation. And I was a very sickly kid. And I think I carried it in my body for a long time. And Rolfing helped me to overcome that, actually. Mm. So I got a body that became flexible and multipotential again. And for my patients, I always recommend that they see somebody who helps them to really feel their body, experience their body, open up to their bodies. And I refer people always to cranial sacral work or Feldenkrais.
Yes.
I think those are all very important components about becoming a healthy person.
But they're not that easy to find. They're still kind of around the edges. Feldenkrais and cranial sacral. Isn't it strange how in Western culture, in a field like psychotherapy, or even I see this a lot in religion, we, in Western culture, we turned these things into these chin-up experiences. We separated ourselves. Yeah. We divided ourselves. I see this. I mean, yoga is everywhere now, right? It's and people are discovering all kinds of ways, as you say, there are all kinds of other ways to reunite ourselves. But
it's true, you know, Western culture is astoundingly disembodied, and uniquely so. Because, you know, because of my work, I've been to South Africa quite a few times, and China and Japan and India. And you see that we are much more disembodied. And the way I like to say it is that we basically come from a post-alcoholic culture. People whose origins are in Northern Europe had only one way of treating distress, that's namely with a bottle of alcohol. And our North American culture continues to continue that notion. If you feel bad, just take a swig or take a pill. Mm-hmm. And the notion that you can do things to change the harmony inside of yourself is just not something that we teach in schools and in our culture and our churches and our religious practices. And of course, if you look at religions around the world, they always start with dancing, moving, singing,
crying, laughing,
physical experiences. Mm-hmm. And then the more respectable people become, the more stiff they become somehow.
And then in the context of your larger work and this subject of trauma, you know, I can look at how modern Western people are kind of intuitively discovering these ways to reclaim their bodies, and that is a way of becoming more resilient. In fact, in an age which has a lot of things to be fearful about, I mean, a lot of change.
Absolutely, and so this is another area of research that I've been on the periphery of, but that's very central to my thinking. And that's research that shows that mindfulness meditation can have a very profound impact on the activation of certain critical parts of your brain that help you be in charge of yourself.
Yeah.
My colleague Britta Hussle, a very young person still here at Harvard, has done a series of studies on MBSR, the mindfulness meditation technique invented by Jon Kabat-Zinn, and finds very significant changes in the medial prefrontal cortex, which is probably the only way by which people can consciously gain control over those primitive parts of their brain.
You noted somewhere also that Western psychology has always valued thinking things through. Mm. Other cultures, places like China, Japan, India, and Africa, have had ways to emphasize self-regulation, which is, I mean, it's just another way of talking about what you just said about what mindfulness-based stress reduction does. Yeah. I also would like to ask you just about this EMDR. And because I had not heard of this before.
Oh, really?
You know, I hadn't.
So, well, EMDR is a bizarre and wondrous treatment. And anybody who first hears about it, and myself included, thinks this is pretty hokey and strange. It's something invented by Francine Shapiro, who found that if you move your eyes from side to side as you think about distressing memories, that the memories lose their power. And because of some experiences, both with myself, but even more with patients of mine who told me about their experiences, I took a training in it, turned out to be incredibly helpful. And then I did what's probably the largest NIH-funded study on EMDR. And we found that of people with adult-onset trauma, so one-time trauma as an adult, that it had the best outcome of any treatment that has been published. About 80% of our patients were cured at the end of the study, which is higher than any other study that has ever been published. And so what's intriguing about EMDR is both how well it works, and then the question is how it works, and that got me into this dream stuff that I talked about earlier, and how it does not work through figuring things out and understanding things, but it activates some natural processes in the brain that help you to integrate these past memories.
And I mean, it sounds so simple. And even when I was reading about it, moving your eyes back and forth, I mean, is this something you can do for yourself, or is there something more complex going on?
It's probably easier. I imagine it can be done, but it's usually better if you do it with somebody else who sort of stays with you, helps you to focus, makes the eye movements for you by having somebody else follow your fingers.
Right.
But it's astoundingly effective treatment. And it's interesting that even though, even in the most biased studies, EMDR keeps coming up as this very effective treatment, it's been very difficult to get funding to find out the very intriguing underlying mechanisms of it. And I think if we really find out the mechanisms for EMDR, we'll understand how the mind works much better. Mm. It's an astoundingly effective treatment. And so if people have had one terrible thing that they cannot get out of their mind, that for me is the treatment of choice.
Mm.
Of course, the people who come to see me in my practice oftentimes have had multiple traumas at the hands of their intimates also.
Right.
So then it gets much more complicated than just a memory issue. But if it's just a car accident or a simple assault, it's astoundingly effective. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Something else I read is you were reflecting on Hurricane Hugo. Hurricanes in general were natural disasters. This phenomenon we see of people helping each other, of getting out there and helping each other. And you also look at that and see that it's not just that people are helping each other, that it's they're moving their bodies. Again, there's this physical involvement as an kind of as an antidote to the helplessness of the situation, which is so manifest.
Good. I'm really glad you read it. Because, people talk a lot about stress hormones and how stress hormones are sort of the source of all evil. That's definitely not true. Stress hormones are good for you. You secrete stress hormones in order to give you the energy to cope under extreme situations. So it gives you that energy to stay up all night with your sick kid or to shovel snow in Minnesota and Boston and stuff like that. But goes wrong is if you're kept from using your stress hormones. So if somebody ties you down, if somebody holds you down, if somebody keeps you imprisoned, the stress hormones keep going up, but you cannot discharge it with action. And then the stress hormones really start wreaking havoc with your own internal system.
Right.
But as long as you move, you are going to be fine. And so, as we know, after these hurricanes and these terrible things, people get very active and they like to help and they like to do things and they enjoy doing it because it discharges their energy.
So we are healing ourselves. We don't realize that.
Well, we're using our natural system, basically. Mm-hmm. It's not only healing, we're coping. We're just dealing with what we need to cope with. Mm-hmm. That's why you have that stuff.
Right.
That's why we survive as a species.
Right.
The thing is that you need to really help people to use their natural stress hormones to engage in actions that make them feel good. Mm-hmm. And so if you take action, at the end you feel satisfied. You feel, I've done it.
Mm-hmm.
You look at your building that's been rebuilt or the 2x4s that you have put back in your building and the roof that you have put back on, you say, I did it.
Mm.
I'm conquering nature.
Yeah.
And so what was disturbing in Hurricane Hugo, which is my first encounter with quite a long time ago, and what we saw again in New Orleans, is how these victimized populations were prevented from doing something.
And
that's really what the observation was.
And that compounded the trauma.
Yeah. And so I get flown into Puerto Rico after Hurricane Hugo, because I've written a book about trauma. I knew nothing about disasters, but nobody else knew anything either, so they flew me in. And what struck me, I land in Puerto Rico, and everybody is busy doing stuff and building things, and everybody's too busy to talk to me because they're trying to do stuff. But on the same plane that I flew in with, officials from FEMA came in, who then made announcements, stop your work until FEMA decides what you're going to get reimbursed for.
Right, right.
And that was the worst thing that could have happened, because now these people were using the energy to fight with each other and to pick quarrels with each other instead of rebuilding their houses. And that's, of course, similar to what happened in New Orleans, where people also were kept from being agents in their own recovery.
I wonder how you look at this world we live in now, where it feels like there's an acceleration of what you might call collective traumatic events or tragedies, right? And it, for whatever reason, I'm sure we could talk about that for hours. It seems to be more and more predictable that around the corner there will be a bombing or a school shooting or a terrible event that's involved with the weather. And how does what you know about trauma help you think about this? Or that's the question.
No, I'm not sure if I share that view with you. Mm-hmm. I think there's so much more news, so we are much more aware of whatever happens at any particular moment. And of course, the news media, when you wake up in the morning, find the worst thing that happens somewhere in the world to serve it to you for breakfast. And so we get served much more. I don't think there's more trauma, actually. You know, when I...
You don't think more bad things happen? You
just how Abe Lincoln grew up.
Right.
You know, he lost his mother and they moved their houses all the time and they were starving and he had nothing. I mean, you read the stories about all the immigrants, all these people who died and the number of assaults in New York City and around the country. And I don't think we live in the worst world. And I think people are also much more conscious today than they were, let's say, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really have studied the history of trauma. You know, my favorite human folly is the First World War. If you think the world is bad right now,
think
about the First World War, unbelievable. So, you know, I don't think things are necessarily worse. And I think, you know, when I go around the country and I see the number of programs that very good-hearted people have for school kids, etc., I'm continuously astounded by the amount of integrity and creativity and goodwill that I see everywhere around me. At the same time that you see something as horrendous as an announcement I read in the New York Times last week, that in Philadelphia, the school system of the public schools in Philadelphia abolished arts programs, gymnastics, counseling, and music programs.
Right.
And I go, where have these people been? In order to have a mind that focuses, you need to move your body.
Right.
You need to sing with other people. And if you think that your kids are going to do better, if you keep them stock still in a classroom taking tests, you don't know anything about human beings. And so you still hear about horrendous things all the time. But I see a great deal of consciousness at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have two friends who are former Turkish students of mine who are involved in what's happening in Taksim Square there. So I get their little blog post.
Yeah.
And I see that people are really trying to carve out more consciousness and more democracy in various places around the world.
Right. I mean, so, you're right. It's all these things at once. I mean, but let's say something I'm aware of is how... and this would be different from the First World War era, where we get these pictures, these vivid images with this immediacy brought to us, right? And I personally, and I mean, I think this is true collectively too, I don't know what to do with those images, right? And what I often, I mean, it's so disturbing, and then there's also this impulse that you just have to cut yourself off from that feeling, right? Because I can't do anything for that particular picture, and then there's this guilt and this feeling that that's not a satisfactory reaction. I mean, it's all together.
Well, you know, see, there's a very dark side to it, to this also, and that is that there's a certain tropism, a movement towards misery in our lives. So that if things become too quiet, it becomes boring, and people go, you know, when you see the preview of coming attractions in the movie theaters, you go like, oh my God, what are these people watching? That people are drawn towards horrendous stuff all the time.
Right.
And so it is part of a dark side of human nature to want to live on that edge.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very hard.
And I watch some of that, too, and I make a distinction between the things that are real and the things that are not real. Okay, let me ask you, this is a different kind of question. So when things do happen, like traumas that we all somehow vicariously take in through Twitter and television, and, you know, like the Boston Marathon bombing or school shootings, you always hear about, you know, that the next day in the school, counselors are being set up. And when I read your research, I wonder, is that the right response? I mean, it's clearly a compassionate response, and it seems like an obvious response. But do we leap too much to having people talk about it and not taking in this big view of what's really happening to us?
Well, you know, I was in Japan when the Boston Marathon things happened, which was two blocks from my home, actually. Mm. But you know, I got a lot of emails about it, and I was pretty impressed with how people dealt with it. You know, there's a very, for one thing, the technology of how people were taken to hospitals and immediately was really stunning. And there was this very rapid, very thoughtful response, actually, and then not a hysterical response at all. And then very quickly, there were these very good news analyses about who these bombers were. Mm-hmm. And the stunning realization that the kids who did the bombing were not so different from the rest of us. Yeah. They went to a school where I know a lot of kids who went to the school that these kids went to. These were kids who largely grew up in America and who were disgruntled adolescents. And it brought home how close it is, you know, how fragile our species is and how hard it is to predict who will turn out okay and who will not be okay. But I was very pleased with the response of the medical system and the authorities and the politicians here in Boston with the bombing. Mm. And I thought it was good that people talked about it and normalized it and talked about it. These things happen. I was pretty pleased. But I was not pleased by is that right after I came home, there's this big to-do down Boylston Street here in Boston of people getting very drunk, screaming patriotic slogans, which was yet another excuse to just spew hatred rather than be mindful about the tragedy that happened. Mm. But now, overall, I was pretty pleased with how it dealt with.
You know, it's very hopeful that you spend your life working with trauma, with victims, and in this research, but you have a pretty refreshingly a hopeful feeling about us as a species.
Well, you see, part of that I get from my patients. You know, what is so gratifying about his work is that you get to see the life force, and that people go through horrendous stuff everywhere all the time, and yet people go on with their lives. And
you see that, you experience that.
I see it all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I see kids who grew up under terrible circumstances, and some of them do terribly. But then, you know, so last week we had our conference here, our annual conference in Boston, and somebody presented her work on doing meditation in maximum security jails. Mm-hmm. And you see these really bad-ass guys come to life because of this meditation program. Mm. And, you know, I see people getting better with another program that I'm involved with is a Shakespeare program for juvenile delinquents here in Berkshire County, where the judge gives kids a choice between going to prison or being condemned to be a Shakespeare actor. And, you know, I go to the Shakespeare program, and these actors do a beautiful job with these kids, and you see these kids come to life as they're being valued as an actor and a person who is able to talk. Mm. So I see, you know, what I see is the huge, huge potential that people have to crawl out of their holes.
Right. You know, when I read your research and I think about this whole picture that we've been discussing of all the different ways people are reaching out for methods to become more self-aware. Mm-hmm. Yoga, meditation, yep. Using these insights of neuroscience. Sometimes I wonder if, you know, 50 years from now or 100 years from now, people might look back on therapy, the way we did it, we've done it for 50 years or whatever, and see it as a really rudimentary step towards a much more profound, you know, reaching for awareness and consciousness, mm-hmm. mindfulness.
Well, you know, I think people have always done good therapy, huh? And our culture and our insurance structure is not really geared towards really very good therapy, nor is our psychological training, which is there to fix people and get rid of their disorder as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. But therapy, as in people really getting to know themselves very well and examining themselves and being seen and being heard and being understood, has always been around, and I think it will always be around. And I don't think we'll ever talk about it as necessarily primitive, mm-hmm. because the intimate interchange of people really talking about their deepest feelings and their deepest pain and having persons listen to it has always been, and I think always will be, a very powerful human experience. It gets all messed up when we need to run it through diagnostic procedures and insurance codes and stuff like that. It gets very complicated. But the process in and of itself is a very important process.
So the language people sometimes use about trauma would be, you know, there's a lot of spiritual language that we intuitively grasp for, you know, soul stealing. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you think about the human spirit in the context of what you know about trauma and resilience and healing?
That's a very tough question.
I know. I think you're up to it, though.
Something that I've tended to stay away from. But, you know, I think trauma really does confront you with the best and the worst. Huh? You mm-hmm. see the horrendous things that people do to each other, but you also see resiliency, the power of love, the power of caring, the power of commitment, the power of commitment to oneself, to the knowledge that there are things that are larger than our individual survival. And some of the most spiritual people I know are exactly traumatized people because they have seen the dark side. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I don't think you can appreciate the glory of life unless you also know the dark side of life.
Right.
And I think my traumatized people certainly know about the dark side of life, but they also, because of that, see the other side better.
You said somewhere that PTSD has opened the door to scientific investigation of the nature of human suffering.
Ah.
I mean, that's really, that's a profound step, right? I mean, that's a spiritual way to talk about, talk about this field without romanticizing, you know, with a profound understanding of what the word spiritual means.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this field has opened up two areas. One is the area of trauma and survival and suffering, but the other one is also people are studying the nature of human connections and the connection between us, mm-hmm. also from a scientific point of view. Last week we had our annual trauma conference here in Boston, and your own Alan Shroof, who has run the Minnesota longitudinal study, which I hope you're familiar with, was a presenter. Mm. And I was just blown away by the depth of his work, which has been going on now for 40 years, of following people up who, while they were still in the womb, mm. and looking at how these creatures developed over time. They're now 40 years old. And how their relationship to their mothers and their attachment system formed how they saw themselves and the world around them and their connections with themselves and with each other. And so, as much as trauma has opened up things, I think the other very important arm of scientific discovery is how the human connection is being looked at scientifically now, and what really happens when two people see each other, when two people respond to each other, when people mirror each other when two bodies move together in dancing and smiling and talking. There's a whole new field of interpersonal neurobiology that is studying how we are connected with each other and how a lack of connection, particularly early in life, has devastating consequences on the development of mind and brain.
And it's true, isn't it, from your study that if people learn to inhabit their bodies, to be more self-aware, that these qualities and habits can create resilience, can serve when trauma hits. Is that right?
Absolutely. So if you, particularly if you're, there's two factors here. One is your reptilian brain. If you breathe quietly in your body and you feel your bodily experience and stuff happens to you, you notice that something is happening out there and you say, oh, this really sucks. This is really unpleasant. But it's something that is not you. So you don't necessarily get hijacked by unpleasant experiences. And the big issue for traumatized people is that they don't own themselves anymore. Any loud sound, anybody insulting them, hurting them, saying bad things, can hijack them away from themselves.
Right.
And so what we have learned is that what makes you resilient to trauma is to own yourself fully. And if somebody says hurtful or insulting things, you say, interesting that person is saying hurtful and insulting things.
But you can separate your sense of yourself.
Yeah, but
from
you can
them.
Separate yourself from it. And we, I think, are really beginning to seriously understand how human beings can learn how to do that, to observe and not react.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about, I'm very intrigued by this new sense that this whole idea of closure that we've lived with in our culture for such a long time, getting closure with bad events, is really a myth. And and I wonder how you think about this idea of closure.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that. I haven't thought about it for a long time, but in my training, we had these lengthy seminars on termination with patients. And I never took to it. I always, time has borne me out in that I still fairly regularly see patients who I saw 30, 20, or 40, even now by now 40 years ago, who I've known off and on for a very long time. And I think relationships last over time. And one's perceptions of one's parents, one's upbringing, one's hurt and pain changes as you grow and get a different perspective. I think the moment you have babies of your own, your perception of yourself as a baby changes, and your perception of your parents changes.
That's so true. Yeah.
So we are in flux.
Right.
Our nature is that we're in flux.
And what you're describing is we integrate these things, right? We don't cut them off. They become more fully part of us, but we're more aware of how they're part of us. Well, I think I just want to come back as we close to this idea. Just a little bit to this idea of our bodies. There's something you said. Let me just find this. Where is this? I have all these notes. That somehow the point of all of this, the take home for you, and I'm not finding the quote, is that we have to feel safe. That we have to feel safe, and that we have to feel safe in our. That has to be a bodily perception, not just a cognitive perception.
Yeah.
And that somehow everything comes back to that.
it is the foundation, But you need to actually feel that feeling. And you need to know what is happening in your body. You need to know where your right toe is and where your pinky is and where your body is. You need to sort of be aware.
It's very nitty-gritty.
It's very, very basic.
Yeah.
Now, you know, what's sorely lacking in our diagnostic system is simple things like eating and peeing and pooping, because that is the foundation of everything, and breathing. Like, you know, these are foundational things, all of which go wrong, but you get traumatized. The most elementary body functions go awry when you are terrified.
Yeah.
And so trauma treatment starts at the foundation of a body that can sleep, a body that can rest, a body that feels safe, a body that can move. And I love the example of your guy who's paraplegic and who does yoga, because even when your body is impaired, you can still learn to own it and to have it.
Yes. You know, he says he's not cured, but he's healed, right?
Yeah.
And here's a striking statement you've made, that victims are members of society whose problems represent the memory of suffering, rage, and pain in a world that longs to forget.
Did I say that?
You did.
That's brilliant. That's great.
And I find that so worthy of reflection. You know, the in a sense, you know, the important place of victims, what they have to teach all of us.
Yeah.
You want to say anything more about that?
Well, you know, that's the literature we read, that's the movies we watch, and that's what we want to be inspired by. Mm-hmm. That's what we observe, is that spirit. Toni Morrison and people who can, and Maya Angelou, and just people who can talk very articulately about having dealt with and stared adversity in the face and still maintain their humanity and faith. That's,
right,
that's,
and kind of coming back to where we started, help us collectively as a species, as communities, as a culture, put those memories into a proper narrative, right?
See, I think a very critical piece that I thought you would come back to also is this notion of being independent people versus being interdependent people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And this notion of demonizing other people and in order to glorify yourself. And the essential thing that you really get to see when you deal with trauma is how we all have these dark sides and we all have these light sides, and that we're all in the same boat. Mm-hmm. And that you am I in a fundamental way, that your humanity and my humanity is the same humanity. And I cannot be a human being without you, and vice versa. I learned that most profoundly when I was a consultant to the Truth Commission in South Africa,
right.
And I got to see some of that process. And the process in South Africa was centered around the issue of Ubuntu.
Yes.
We can, I am because you are. And I can only be alive to the degree that you're alive, and we are all living in the same universe, and we are sharing it together. I mean, and I think that's really one of the great lessons from being from learning about trauma, is that when you get traumatized, you think you are in the world all by yourself. Mm. And I hear many people talk, including supposedly well-functioning people, who talk about ourselves as if we are in the world by ourselves, but we aren't. We are organisms that come and go and share this common planet, and we have an impact on each other. And the more I deal with trauma, the more this issue of feeling safe interiorly but being connected with other people at the same time is really the essence of treatment and healing and going on with your life.
Mm.
But also knowing that you're just a part of a very large whole.
Mm. Well, thank you. And anything else you would want to just talk about that I didn't touch on?
Well, you ask great questions, and I like this quote that you've had back to me.
I'll send it to you if you want.
That's great.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
You're welcome. We'll let you know when we're producing this and send you all the info, and it's just been really a pleasure. Thank you.
Really a pleasure. Same thing here.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.